I next met with Dr. Sarah Holstein from the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
So I saw this 58-year-old gentleman shortly after he had been diagnosed with myeloma. He came to me as a second opinion. This was obviously quite a surprise for him, and he wanted to see a myeloma specialist and just learn a little bit more about his disease before he committed to starting therapy that had been recommended by his local oncologist. So when he presented, he did have a diagnostic bone marrow, and they did do FISH, which didn't show at the time any true high-risk abnormalities. So it showed deletion 13q, 1q positive, as well as some trisomies. The FISH done on the outside did report some sort of IgH rearrangement, but they really couldn't identify the partner, so nothing more was done with that. So when I saw him, we discussed standard treatment for newly diagnosed myeloma because he was 58 and otherwise healthy. We talked about the role of consolidation with autologous stem cell transplant, and I strongly encouraged him to do that following his induction therapy.
What was his life situation and work, et cetera?
So he was working full-time and really was otherwise healthy. And so he wanted to go through therapy kind of as quickly as possible and get back to work as quickly as possible.
So what was the first opinion and what were your thoughts about that?
The first opinion also talked about the same induction regimen that I ultimately recommended, which was RVD or lenalidomide bortezomib and dexamethasone. He had had kind of minimal discussion about the role of autologous stem cell transplant, kind of knew a little bit about it, but it hadn't really been clear to him whether this was something that should be done following induction or whether this could be done sometime later in his disease course.
So what happened?
So after discussing with him the data that are out there for the role of upfront transplant, he ultimately went back to his local oncologist because he does live several hours away from where we are, and he received his four cycles of lenalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone or RVD induction therapy, and he achieved a partial response. I had set him up with one of the bone marrow transplant colleagues at my institution, and he underwent a standard melphalan 200 autologous stem cell transplant in May. And then I saw him again for his post-transplant evaluation after he had completed the day 90 bone marrow biopsy and all the other laboratory studies.
And what did his evaluation show at that point?
So at that point, he would be judged as a very good partial response because he did still have a very small M-spike left in his serum. But really, the reason that the bone marrow transplant colleague wanted me to see him again was that the FISH that was done on this marrow now was able to provide more clarification about that possible IgH rearrangement. And in fact, our cytogenetics lab identified a translocation 14-16, which of course is associated with high-risk disease. And so my colleague really thought that it would benefit the patient to talk more with me as to whether or not just single-agent lenalidomide maintenance was sufficient or whether we should do something a little bit more aggressive given the high-risk cytogenetic disease.
So what did you decide to do?
So I talked to him at length. You know, when he first started talking to me, and I hadn't seen him since, again, before he received treatment, so I really hadn't had a chance to see how he had done with his induction therapy. He told me that induction therapy had gone horribly. He felt very sick. He had lots of side effects that he attributed to lenalidomide, to bortezomib, and he didn't think he wanted any additional treatment. But we had a very long conversation about the role of maintenance therapy in general, and of course, what studies show when you look at taking placebo or observation versus taking lenalidomide. And then we had an even longer discussion about high-risk features and in general how their duration of remission is significantly shorter.
Could you talk a little bit more about the problems that he had with RVD? And do you think he had more problems than other people or he was more sensitive to them?
I think he was more sensitive. So one of the problems, which of course is significant when we think about what to do post-transplant, was neuropathy, peripheral neuropathy, primarily in his feet, but somewhat in his hands as well. And this started occurring partway through his induction therapy and then really seemed to worsen after the transplant, although he did admit kind of the further he got out from transplant, the better the neuropathy was getting in his feet. So that was expected.
He got sub-Q bortezomib weekly?
He did, yep, in the standard dosing.
And again, looking at him objectively, would you say that the amount of neuropathy he had was more than you typically see?
Not more than you typically see, but I think he was just sensitive to that sort of side effect. So it really bothered him at night when the covers were brushing his feet. It really bothered him to have any light touch sensation on his feet, but he really wasn't having burning pain sensation that you see with the more severe bortezomib-induced peripheral neuropathy. He wasn't having balance issues. I think he had been one of those individuals who was previously very, very healthy and hadn't had side effects because he wasn't really on medicines before, and so was just a little bit more sensitive. He did note that he had started wearing compression stockings about 2 weeks before he saw me, and that seemed to be helping. Again, whether it was the compression stockings or simply just more time away from the melphalan, it's a little bit hard to know.
Interesting. So what did you decide to do?
So, you know, I presented him with all the information, talked about, look, if you don't do anything, here's my best guess as to when you will relapse. And that best guess was probably 12 to 18 months. If you take lenalidomide, you know, here's my best guess is when you will relapse. And then we talked at length about the fact that we don't have phase 3 data supporting the use of triplet maintenance therapy post-transplant, but that we know from both newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory setting that the combination of an IMID and a proteasome inhibitor can at least partially abrogate the effects of high-risk disease, and that if the goal is to really try to keep his disease under control for as long as possible, my recommendation would be to use triplet maintenance therapy. Now, the kind of standard out there at this point in time is based on a manuscript out of Emory by Nuka et al., where they used kind of a modified lenalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone maintenance regimen for their high-risk patients for up to 3 years. Because of the peripheral neuropathy and because of the patient's very strong opinion that he never wanted to get treated with bortezomib again, I recommended that we substitute exazomib for bortezomib. I, of course, discussed the fact that we don't really have data supporting this, but that we do know, at least in the relapsed refractory setting, that lenalidomide and exazomib can at least partially overcome the adverse effects associated with high-risk disease, and counseled him that hopefully this regimen would not increase his existing neuropathy and that he should be able to tolerate it. He was still a little bit on the fence about therapy, but we discussed that you could always start, kind of see what his quality of life was, and if it was acceptable to him, then continue for as long as possible.
So what happened?
I saw him just about 2 months ago, so as far as I know, he has started therapy. I told him that if he was not able to tolerate it, that he should come back and see me. Again, he is following with his local oncologist on a regular basis and not me, so I'm assuming that right now, no news is good news.
Can you talk a little bit, because you've obviously been very involved with the research on post-transplant maintenance, mm-hmm. where we are today in terms of what we've learned about post-transplant maintenance, both with lenalidomide, and maybe go a little bit more in depth when we start talking about triplets, but also what we know about the benefits of maintenance based on cytogenetic status and how much, for example, the number that you gave him if he didn't have any maintenance, best guess, best estimate, how that would be actually affected by lenalidomide, for example, without a proteasome inhibitor, and then your best guess about if you use the triplet.
Sure. So at this point in time, I think we have really excellent data supporting the use of single agent lenalidomide maintenance. So really, that's in all comers. So of course, CLGB100-104 was conducted in a time when we really did not have cytogenetic data available. The recently updated analysis, again, despite extensive data cleaning efforts, we really were not able to include any cytogenetic data because it simply wasn't done at that time when patients were being enrolled in around 2005 or so. So we really can't comment on that. What we can comment, of course, is that through multiple phase 3 studies, lenalidomide maintenance significantly prolongs progression-free survival, almost doubles it in most cases, and that if you look at the studies in aggregate through the recently published meta-analysis, there is an overall survival benefit as well. The best data so far for the role of lenalidomide maintenance across all cytogenetic risk factors, risk groups, really comes from the Myeloma 11 study, which thus far has only been presented in abstract form. But there we have really lovely data showing the difference in outcomes between high-risk disease patients and standard-risk disease patients. And of course, not surprisingly, those patients with standard risk do better than those patients with high risk. But importantly, the data that was presented at ASH for this study showed that the addition of lenalidomide improved outcomes regardless of whether you were high risk or standard risk. Now, lenalidomide does not bring the high-risk patients up to the standard risk. There is still definitely an adverse risk associated with high-risk disease, but the data clearly showed that patients with high-risk disease do obtain some benefit with lenalidomide. And so I think that's really important because previously there's always been this bias, I think, against lenalidomide maintenance, saying that, well, it works for patients who are standard risk, but it doesn't work for high risk. And now we finally have high quality data from the Myeloma 11 study showing that that's not the case, that in fact patients with high risk disease do benefit. But again, the overall problem remains that it's not enough to convert high risk to standard risk.
And you referred to the data from Emory. Can you talk a little bit more about that, as well as other, you know, attempts to look at triplet therapy in the maintenance setting, or even consolidation for that matter?
Right. And so, you know, I think the consolidation is a little bit different than the maintenance. You know, certainly there are studies out there, for example, with carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dex, looking at kind of a fixed number of cycles post-transplant, and you can see improved depths of responses, improved deepening of MRD negativity. But in general, those are fixed numbers of cycles and not prolonged duration. Really, the best data we have for that is the Emory study, which, again, was really more of a single institution experience where they took their high-risk patients and gave them this modified RVD regimen for up to 3 years. And if they still hadn't progressed after 3 years, then the idea was to convert them to single-agent lenalidomide. Certainly the outcomes were good, but of course this was not a randomized study. And of course in real life, it's sometimes difficult to try to convince patients to stay on triplet therapy for years at a time.
But on the other hand, the first time I remember hearing about oral proteasome inhibitors, and we have exazimib, which this man received, and there's also aprozomib, which is not approved. My first thought was maintenance. You know, it doesn't seem like it would make that much difference, oral versus IV, for a few courses up front. But when you start thinking about 1 and 2 years, it seems like that's where an oral agent really would come to be useful. What do we know right now about oral proteasome inhibitors, including exazimib, as maintenance?
So we know that it's feasible. I think that's the main thing that we know. Really, at this point in time, we don't have phase 3 data available telling us that it's better than placebo, better than lenalidomide, better as a single agent versus some sort of doublet or triplet. But we do know that prolonged therapy with exazimib is feasible, which I think is a really important point. There was obviously a lot of concern that perhaps GI side effects from exazimib would make it difficult to have a patient stay on long term. But the studies that have been done thus far show, again, the feasibility of it. The question obviously is whether or not exazimib is equivalent to lenalidomide, whether there are subgroups of patients who would benefit more from exazimib than from lenalidomide. Here, I think it gets down to interesting philosophical questions about what we think lenalidomide is really doing in the post-maintenance setting. So is lenalidomide simply achieving anti-myeloma effect, and that's why patients do well for longer? Or is lenalidomide really modulating the immune system and providing kind of an immune context that allows for disease control for longer periods of time? There's been all sorts of discussions amongst the myeloma physicians about whether the dose of lenalidomide that's used in the maintenance, which is usually somewhere between 5 and 10 milligrams, is really sufficient to cause significant anti-myeloma effects, or again, whether the benefit that we see is from immune modification, which of course we know that lenalidomide has those properties. On the flip side, certainly exazimib has anti-myeloma effects, but we think that exazimib has far less immunomodulatory effects than lenalidomide. So from a maintenance perspective, exazimib long-term, are we achieving benefit from simply anti-myeloma effect or immune modulating effect? That I think we don't know.
I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of the question you posed about the lenalidomide, and specifically whether in your mind it's an exciting opportunity or a research thought to combine other immune strategies with lenalidomide in the maintenance setting. Of course, the one obvious one would be elotuzumab. What are your thoughts about that kind of strategy?
You know, it's something that we are very excited about. And I'll just say that through the Alliance Cooperative Group, that's actually a study that we have been trying to get up off the ground for quite some time, looking at lenalidomide with a variety of different partners and really asking the question what happens from an immune modulatory perspective, looking at immune subsets in peripheral blood and marrow, looking at response rates. I think there's many different agents out there, which we know from the relapse refractory setting, have better activity when you combine them with lenalidomide. And it's the number one question right now, which agent should we be using in combination with lenalidomide, or should we be using any combinations? Elotuzumab is a perfect example. Clearly, it's a medication that does not produce a lot of side effects. So from a long-term feasibility perspective, it should be relatively safe and easy to manage for patients. Once you get past the fact that they will be required to go into their infusion centers a couple times a month. From immunomodulatory perspective, elotuzumab has a lot of attractive properties because of its effects not only on myeloma cells, but on natural killer cells. So again, if we think that there is some sort of immune milieu that's really optimal for maintaining disease control, perhaps elotuzumab can contribute to that. But obviously, elotuzumab isn't the only option out there. Obviously, we could add a proteasome inhibitor like ixazomib that we've been discussing. You could add, you know, other monoclonal antibodies like daratumumab. There are newer agents that are starting to be studied, such as HDAC inhibitors, some of which, such as the HDAC6 inhibitors, which are oral and which also could have potential as maintenance therapies. So there's a lot of potential out there. I think the question is, how do we go about designing studies to get answers as quickly as possible?
I guess the other or one other immune potential additive, particularly to an IMiD that has been looked at, but I don't know if it's been looked at in the maintenance setting, would be checkpoint inhibitors. Is there interest in looking at that in the maintenance setting?
There is, absolutely. And in fact, the study that we've been trying to get up off the ground through the Alliance, one of the arms does contain a checkpoint inhibitor. And I know there are some smaller institutional-based studies that are starting to look at that, but thus far I haven't seen any data yet, perhaps this upcoming ASH.
So I want to go back to a couple other aspects of the case that you just presented and get into it a little bit more. One is you mentioned the issue with GI toxicity with ixazomib, and I'm curious what your experience has been with that. Do you start patients on preemptive GI medication or antiemetics, for example? What kinds of GI problems? Is it dose-related?
So my experience is that primarily, it's diarrhea in nature. I've really not seen patients experience nausea and vomiting. I generally will have anti-nausea meds available to the patient at home, but in my experience, they really have not needed it. In the relapsed refractory setting, when my institution participated in the placebo-controlled study of lenalidomide dexamethasone versus lenalidomide dexamethasone and ixazomib, to be honest, I really couldn't tell which patients were receiving active drug versus placebo. So in general, my experience has been that the GI side effects are not overwhelming, but you do have patients who sometimes have diarrhea. In general, that, however, is easily managed with over-the-counter medication.
So another issue with the proteasome inhibitors in general, this man had problems with neuropathy from the bortezomib. What about ixazomib in terms of neuropathy, and where would you put in carfilzomib?
So I would say ixazomib causes a very low frequency of neuropathy based on the clinical trials and also just based on my experience in clinic. For the patients who have bortezomib-induced neuropathy and then get switched over to ixazomib, my experience is that their neuropathy does not worsen. So I think that's an attractive feature of ixazomib. I really have not seen any carfilzomib-induced neuropathy. So from a neuropathy perspective, both ixazomib and carfilzomib seem to be very good. Bortezomib still its biggest problem with respect to long-term administration as the development of the peripheral neuropathy.
So I was also going to ask you about carfilzomib as upfront treatment. Looking back at this man's course, particularly because he was unhappy about the neuropathy, what's your take right now? I mean, carfilzomib has its own set of risks. I mean, obviously, there's a randomized study looking at carfilzomib versus bortezomib as induction therapy. But right now, based on the research data that we have in your own clinical experience, how would you weigh out indirectly the risks and benefits of these two drugs as part of induction?
You know, I think that there's still a lot for us to learn, and I'm eagerly awaiting the results of the ECOG KRD versus RVD study when it's finished. I think what we've seen so far is that there is a toxicity profile for carfilzomib that we did not expect based on all the relapsed refractory studies that have been done previously. I think that there's a cardiopulmonary kind of thromboembolic profile in the newly diagnosed setting. The numbers of patients that are experiencing these serious adverse events are low, but when they do experience them, these events are very serious. So for me, that's been enough to say that I don't start somebody out preemptively on lenalidomide carfilzomib dex. I really want to see the safety data to make sure that we understand and can manage these patients appropriately. But what I will sometimes do is if patients do not have an optimal response to upfront lenalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone, let's say they've maybe achieved a PR, maybe still have 20% of plasma cells left in their bone marrow, and we're trying to get them to transplant, I found that switching over to KRD, so lenalidomide carfilzomib dexamethasone, really in all cases thus far that I've attempted, gets the patient to that very good partial response or bone marrow less than 10% plasma cells and gets us moving on to consolidation with transplant. So that's really my practice thus far. I won't offer KRD upfront until we have phase 3 data showing at least equivalency with respect to efficacy, but also a safety profile that's acceptable. But I will switch patients over if they haven't achieved the optimal response with upfront RVD.
Can you drill down a little bit more in terms of what your take is on the toxicity profile of carfilzomib? It's always been kind of difficult for me to sort of sort out what's going on. I hear about a dyspnea syndrome. I hear people saying there's a small incidence of actual cardiac dysfunction. You said thromboembolic, which I'm not sure I've heard at all. But what specifically do you think is associated with this drug?
You know, I'm not sure that I'm smart enough to answer that. I think what we are learning so far is some vague vascular injury, but that's pretty nonspecific. And I recognize that in what I'm answering. I know that there has been interest in obtaining additional correlative studies from the ECOG study so that we can learn more about this. But the adverse events that we haven't quite predicted have included things like heart attacks, serious PEs. Now, you could say that, well, that's the IMID, but generally these days we know how to manage IMIDs and prevent thromboembolic events associated with IMIDs. And so to have serious pulmonary emboli occur on patients receiving KRD suggests that perhaps this is coming from the carfilzomib, although obviously hard to prove. You know, I don't think we know what it is, but if you're taking somebody who's relatively young and fit and transplant eligible and exposing them to a risk of a serious cardiopulmonary side effect, you really have to be sure that you're doing that for a good reason. And I think right now, we just don't have enough data to tell us that this is, in fact, safe enough to become the new standard of care.
How often do you see a patient who's getting carfilzomib who talks to you about the subjective experience of dyspnea during the infusion? And if they do say that to you, what do you do?
You know, so it's, I would say maybe 25% of the time.
Wow.
I see it. And it's always hard to know what to do. Obviously, you know whether these patients have underlying lung disorders, you know, their baseline COPD, et cetera. Are they managing that as they should? I'm usually pretty strict about not giving a whole lot of pre-hydration fluids, and I really only do it with the first cycle. So I usually don't worry that this is iatrogenic in terms of salt overload from too many fluids pre-post carfilzomib. The discussion varies from patient to patient in terms of how much it's actually bothering them. On occasion, I will do more workup, kind of make sure that there haven't been changes in PFTs, check an echocardiogram, but I've never really found anything objective in those types of evaluations. Ultimately, it's up to the patient. Usually, if they're responding well or if their disease is responding well, and we kind of talk about having them alert me if their symptoms worsen in any way immediately, they feel comfortable continuing on.
So one other aspect of the trial that you mentioned is comparing KRD to RVD, if I believe, is that there's another randomization to 2 years versus indefinite of LEN maintenance. And I'm curious about your thoughts about the rationale behind that and whether you have any hesitancy about putting a patient on that study. I'm going to guess off study. Do you use indefinite LEN maintenance?
Yes, I do use indefinite. And that's because it's based on multiple phase 3 studies, and of course, most notably in this country, CLGB-100-104, in which the lenalidomide was continued until progression. What CLGB-100-104 does not directly address is whether indefinite maintenance is needed. So it definitively answers the question of, yes, lenalidomide maintenance versus placebo confers improved outcomes. But do you get those same improved outcomes for 2 years of LEN versus 3 years versus 5 years versus indefinite? And we simply don't know the answer to that. So I think it's an interesting question to ask. There's, of course, a financial cost to staying on LEN long-term. There's just the daily side effect cost to the patient of staying on LEN long-term that should be considered. If we think, though, that either the two things we talked about earlier, that either Len is manipulating the immune system to create an immune environment that somehow maintains disease control, and or if we think that Len is inducing anti-myeloma effect, then I think it makes sense that continued lenalidomide would provide better outcomes. But we need to do the study to prove it. We'll also have some more indirect kind of study-to-study comparison for the IFM 2009 study versus the Dana-Farber one conducted in this country, where lenalidomide on the French side is continued just for 1 year for maintenance. And of course, in this country, lenalidomide is being continued until disease progression. Here, if you look at the French data, I think you can already start to get a signal that relapses start to happen once you stop lenalidomide maintenance. And that's even in the case if you look at the curves that were published, where they're looking at the patients who achieved MRD negativity. You start to see those curves kind of tick off after the patient stopped lenalidomide maintenance. So I guess my personal bias is that continued therapy will provide better long-term outcomes. But again, we absolutely need the studies to prove that.
But obviously, you're comfortable to put a patient on a study like that.
Yes, yes.
So another kind of related question to this case is the issue of, was this transplant really necessary, or could it have been delayed? I don't know what his life situation was and how much of a problem it caused him work-wise or whatever to have to go through a transplant. But I'm curious what you say to patients about the benefit of transplant. For example, do you believe there's a survival benefit to doing it? Do you believe that patients would do just as well with delayed transplant? And from a practical point of view, do you think there could be a role right now for MRD measurement in trying to make that decision?
So all those are absolutely fantastic questions. First, with respect to the data supporting the use of upfront transplant versus delayed. So I generally will have a discussion about the fact that at this time there are four relatively recent phase three studies which have all addressed that question. You know, you can argue that a few of them done in Europe perhaps use suboptimal induction regimens and therefore and suboptimal chemotherapy versus transplant arms. But even so, the signal across all four studies has been very consistent in terms of the PFS benefit. The survival benefit, yes, in some studies. The IFM 2009 study, we simply don't have long enough follow-up yet to look at survival differences. Right now, there's no difference between upfront and delayed transplant, but both arms are doing exceedingly well. I really tell patients that I believe at this time, upfront transplant should be considered standard of care. Practically speaking, when you have patients who choose to collect their stem cells and perhaps stay on some sort of maintenance therapy, whether it's Len alone, lenalidomide dexamethasone, you know, their quality of life up front might be better because they didn't go through a transplant, but their disease is oftentimes difficult to manage once they do start to progress. So you're progressing on, let's say, Len alone or lenalidomide and dexamethasone. At this point, then, you need to offer some sort of salvage therapy to try to get them to transplant, and it's not always an easy thing to get them to that transplant. And so I think the likelihood of patient getting a transplant is much, much higher if it's done following induction versus waiting until time of first relapse. I also think that the disease sensitivity is improved. In general, we have retrospective data suggesting that the fewer therapies that a patient sees upfront before going to a melphalan-based transplant, the better the outcomes are post-transplant. And so I think it's difficult once you start treating a relapsed patient and trying to clean up their disease, get them to transplant. I think in general, the duration of benefit post-transplant in the delayed setting is shorter than the benefit in the upfront setting. So we talk about all of that. And so I sometimes say that it's, you know, upfront pain for hopefully long-term gain. Whether that's true for every single patient, it's hard to say. We only have aggregate data. We're not very good at individualizing therapy at this point. But I think right now, in the absence of any other studies showing true prolonged remissions without a transplant, I would still offer transplant following induction therapy. This question of MRD negativity is a really interesting one. Obviously, we know that achieving MRD negativity is a good thing. There's no question about that. But where I think it gets murky is whether, well, is it just MRD negativity times one? Is it MRD negativity over a period of a year, over 2 years? What's really important? We all have had patients who achieve MRD negativity and then relapse 6 months later. So MRD negativity does not equal cure. And until we get to the point where we can confidently say that achieving MRD negativity equates to long-term remission, I don't think we can use it to pick which patients don't need a transplant or which patients should go to transplant.
So I'm just kind of curious, though, if a patient like this one, for example, a young patient, says to you, well, I live longer by taking an immediate transplant as opposed to collecting my cells. How would you answer that?
I would say I honestly don't know. I think the answer is yes, but we just don't know. Based on the study, which is most applicable to him, the IFM 2009 study, the answer is in the short term, no, based on, you know, 3-year survival data. But long term, my suspicion is still that upfront transplant is going to confer better survivals. So I'm always very honest with my patients and try to discuss the available data and then try to distinguish between what my recommendation is based on, whether it's based on data or whether it's based on kind of personal judgment.
And we've been talking a little bit about MRD measurement. Could you talk a little bit about what we know right now about the clinical utility of that strategy and whether you think it's worth doing for a general oncologist and community-based practice?
So I think right now MRD measurement is not ready for prime time. I think it really should just be confined to the use in clinical trials. Part of that is because we still are trying to figure out what the best way is to measure it. We're still trying to get uniformity in how we measure it. And mostly it's because we don't truly know what to do with the data. So yes, we know that achieving MRD negativity is good, but we don't know how to use that to individualize treatment decisions. And if you're getting a piece of information that you don't know how to use, then I'm not sure that we should be getting it in the day-to-day practice.
So I'm going to go into your next case, but one final question about this case, which is what your trigger finger is to use exazimib. So if you think about the possibility of using exazimib, everything from starting with upfront as part of induction to maintenance, as we've been talking about, to relapse disease, what does it take for you to consider it? For example, if a patient says, you know, maybe the patient's very well informed, the patient might be a physician, whatever, and says to you, I know there's an oral drug out there, and I just don't really like coming into clinic. I'd rather take a pill. Is that enough for you to go, okay, or do you need it to be, it's a 2-hour drive, or they've had some kind of complication? How interchangeable do you think exazimib and bortezomib is in the spectrum of disease?
I don't think we know the answer to that yet. Much of my use has been in the relapsed refractory setting. Obviously, it's not approved yet for the upfront setting. And so I really have not used it for any newly diagnosed patient. I have on occasion made the substitution after patients have started getting neuropathy with bortezomib. It's a little bit difficult to piece out the benefit of exazimib in patients who have progressed on bortezomib. There, I worry that you aren't going to get a lot of disease benefit. But for patients who are still sensitive to bortezomib, but perhaps either couldn't tolerate it because of side effects, or it's just inconvenient because of travel distance, I think it's probably acceptable to switch out, but we just don't know that yet. And to be honest, I think we aren't even sure yet what the optimal dosing schedule is of exazimib. Obviously, it was approved in the weekly dosing, 3 weeks on, 1 week off of lenalidomide, but obviously there's been more recent data going back to the type of dosing schedule that was studied in one of the phase one studies where it's twice weekly. And so I'm a little bit hesitant to especially offer it to a newly diagnosed transplant eligible patient when we know what to expect with RVD for response rates and we're still a little bit unsure in the transplant eligible population what to expect with lenalidomide exazimib dex and whether we need to be giving it once weekly or twice weekly. And again, in the relapsed refractory setting, I would mainly use it in patients who, for some reason, did not receive lenalidomide with their upfront treatment and who were still bortezomib sensitive.
So I want to try to go through your other cases, and we went into a lot of detail about this first case because it seemed like a really good case to do that. But we'll probably pick up the pace a little bit and sort of focus on some of the key teaching points from each one of these cases, beginning with your 59-year-old man.
Right. So he's a gentleman who I met late last year after he was relapsing post-transplant. So he's a gentleman with IgA kappa myeloma. He had been diagnosed in late 2014 with his myeloma. He did have a translocation 414 at time of diagnosis. He received induction therapy with lenalidomide bortezomib dex, achieved a complete response with that. There were some delays with respect to collecting his stem cells and then getting him to transplant, but he eventually did get to transplant in September 2015. His post-transplant eval showed that everything looked good. He was still in a complete response, and he started len maintenance. In reviewing his records, when he was referred to me, there was evidence of biochemical relapse by May 2016. So really only 5 or 6 months after being placed on len maintenance, he already relapsed from a CR, which of course is not ideal. He then had some difficulties. They kept him on the lenalidomide maintenance. He had an episode of pancreatitis. His treating oncologist decided to stop the lenalidomide. And not surprisingly, he had further evidence of disease progression, and that's when he was referred to me. So at that time, checked his marrow again. He had 13% plasma cells, no new findings really on FISH. And so we talked about the fact that with the translocation 414, that's really considered a higher risk cytogenetic problem, and ultimately ended up recommending the combination of pomalidomide, daratumumab, and dexamethasone. And so after 4 cycles of that, he achieved a serological CR. We have not repeated a bone marrow biopsy to confirm the CR, but he remains on it and is doing quite well from a myeloma perspective.
Just to go back to one point, I was going to ask you when we were talking about maintenance before, but I think this case brings that up, which is before we get into the therapy on him in relapse, was the decision to use len maintenance in spite of the fact that he was in CR. What do we know about the benefit of len maintenance in patients who are in CR? And for that matter, I don't know, but what do we know about the benefit of maintenance in patients who are MRD negative?
So excellent question. CLGB100-104, you know, that's one of the things that we looked at. And the short answer is that if you are in a CR and you get len maintenance, you do even better than if you were in CR and got placebo. So it's not uncommon to hear from the community the perception that if you're in a CR, you don't need maintenance. And that's simply not true based on the available data. Again, 100-104 clearly demonstrates that you do benefit from maintenance, even if you are in a CR. In addition, I think what we know so far about MRD negativity is that you do benefit from maintenance there as well, but we clearly have less data at this point.
Could you talk a little bit about what your thought process was about the various options that were available at, you know, the point that you decided to treat him with the pom-dara-dex? What were the other thoughts that you had about possible therapies in that situation? And how do you approach the issue of first relapse in myeloma?
It's really becoming more and more complex because we have more and more good triplet therapies. We, of course, know that in general, triplets are better than doublets, so that answer is relatively easy, but the question of which triplet to use and when is very complicated. Many of the phase 3 studies that we have aren't necessarily relevant to the U.S. population with respect to all the phase 3 studies that looked at Lendex versus Lendex plus something else, all of which showed that the triplet was better than the doublet. And that's primarily because most of these studies did not include Len refractory patients. You can always argue whether relapsing on len maintenance truly makes you refractory to len. I think sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is no. But with him, he had a very, very short disease control duration following transplant, despite being on len maintenance. And I just was not willing to kind of risk the strategy of putting him on higher dose len plus something else, and then kind of wasting that other partner. And so I really wanted to switch gears completely and use a triplet that would be completely novel to him. Whether or not that's the right approach, I don't know. Again, I tend to be a little bit more aggressive in patients with high-risk disease or patients who are behaving like they have high-risk disease, namely relapsing very quickly after transplant despite maintenance therapy. The thought process for pom-dara-dex included possibly using pomalidomide carfilzomib dexamethasone instead. Obviously, that's also a very potent triplet therapy. Again, we know that the combination of IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors together can confer improved outcomes for high-risk patients. My problem with using pomalidomide, carfilzomib, dexamethasone is that once you progress on that, it's not clear what you do after that and how you partner daratumumab. So the idea with picking pomalidomide, daratumumab, dexamethasone was that it would leave carfilzomib for another partner for the next line of therapy.
What would you be thinking about if this man does develop another disease progression?
I would probably, assuming we didn't have any good clinical trials, because clinical trial is always an excellent option, I would probably think about cyclophosphamide, carfilzomib, dexamethasone. I found it to be a very well-tolerated triplet regimen, and it's a way to get another drug in with carfilzomib.
Can you talk a little bit about the pragmatic issues of using daratumumab, particularly related to the infusion, what your thoughts are about sub-Q daratumumab, and how this man has done on it?
You know, so the first infusion of daratumumab is always a little bit tricky. I think it really helps to have personnel who are familiar with the drug giving it. You know, a lot of times what I'll do when I'm partnering with community oncologists is offer to have their patients get the first dose in our center. We're open 24 hours a day, so there's not this issue of, is the infusion going to be done before 5 o'clock rings? And again, experience of nursing with the infusions really helps as well. I think that appropriately pre-medding does help with some. I uniformly now will add in Singulair as a pre-medication. Again, if patients have any COPD history, I'll make sure that they are using their inhalers and nebulizing treatments. But even despite doing everything possible, most patients will still have some sort of infusion reaction. And it's really, I usually counsel the patients that it's just really going to be mostly a boring day for them. So it's not necessarily that these infusion reactions are scary. They aren't, at least in my experience, like first-time rituximab infusions. But it's just a matter of kind of slogging through the infusion, starting, stopping until all of their little reactions, which really can be as kind of simple as a runny nose or sniffly nose, kind of calms down. In general, after the first infusion, things go very smoothly. I've really not had issues with second dose infusions. Having said all that, of course, I'm excited about the potential for sub-Q daratumumab. It's, of course, difficult even in a larger center to be able to get those 8 to 12 hour chairs for daratumumab. And obviously, for patient experience, it's going to be much more preferable to have a shorter infusion time.
What do we know about sub-Q daratumumab in terms of efficacy? And I don't know if you know anything about the actual technical aspects of how it's done, how much volume of fluid involves.
So my understanding is that that's still a little bit in flux based on what was described at this last ASH in terms of how it was administered versus what was recently described to me in a pre-site study visit for a study that's going to involve sub-Q Dara. So I think that they're still working a little bit on it, at least when they presented it at ASH. I think there were multiple injection sites. I think there might have been some sort of pump that was used, actually. And I don't know if they've been able to decrease the volume. It's definitely more than just a simple, you know, 5cc sub-Q shot. But with respect to efficacy, it looks like so far the preliminary numbers look to be equivalent to what we saw with the initial phase 1-2 data with IV daratumumab. Obviously, there's going to be, or it's perhaps already in progress, a larger study that's directly comparing the efficacy of the two preparations.
Where do you think daratumumab is heading? You know, ever since I first started hearing about it, people talked about it maybe becoming the rituximab of myeloma, you know, being added to everything up front, et cetera. And I think there were some data presented at ASCO looking at it. I think it was up front with RVD. What do we know about using it earlier? And do you think that's where we're heading?
I think that's probably where we're headed. You know, the initial kind of feasibility shows that it is feasible. An important study that is being done partnering with the Alliance is a study that is a phase 2 randomized study looking at RVD followed by transplant, followed by RVD and lenalidomide maintenance versus the same backbone, but with daratumumab added at every point. And so it would not surprise me if that becomes the new standard of care so that we're seeing daratumumab in the upfront setting and the maintenance setting. What that then means in the relapse setting, I don't know. I don't know if it should be used the way we use rituximab in the lymphoma world, which is, okay, you switch out the chemo, but you still leave in the rituximab. I think at this point, we don't fully understand the mechanisms for resistance for daratumumab. And obviously, we need to understand that to know whether we should keep it on board for second-line therapy, third-line therapy, et cetera. And of course, with the other types of monoclonal antibodies out there, should we be combining them or should we simply be removing daratumumab once a patient becomes refractory to their current line of therapy? I don't know.
So let's see, you have several patients here under the category of interesting patients. They all look kind of complicated, but maybe you can sort of kind of get from a teaching point of view, summarize kind of what happened with the patient. And from your point of view, you know, what the key teaching point is, maybe beginning with this 41-year-old lady.
Sure. So she's an extraordinarily complex patient, and it's just a good example of sometimes what you can see at a teaching institute. So she presented last year. So everything that's going to have happened will have happened in just a little over a year's period of time. But she was diagnosed with lambda light chain myeloma, but she also had evidence of amyloid in her bone marrow. So she presented with high calcium and evidence of lytic disease. So pretty typical newly diagnosed myeloma. She didn't have anything particularly worrisome on FISH, and she didn't appear to have obvious evidence of cardiac involvement with her amyloid. And so the decision was made by her local oncologist to start standard induction therapy with lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone. She initially had evidence of response based on her light chains, but then appeared to plateau. At that point, a follow-up bone marrow was done, and she had gone from about 85% plasma cells at time of diagnosis to 40%, so a good response, but not really ready to be collected and proceed with transplant. The treating oncologist then decided to use daratumumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone as second-line therapy. And again, she had evidence of response based on light chains and decreasing plasma cell content in her marrow, but it was kind of a slow response. And notably on cytogenetics, every time she would have a bone marrow, there would be new clones evident. So a little bit concerning that her disease was becoming more aggressive. Her daratumumab therapy with bortezomib was complicated by development of unilateral pleural effusion, and she had multiple taps initially, which showed no evidence of malignancy. She was referred to me with the question of, should they continue the daratumumab bortezomib dex? She was still technically responding, so I said yes, and we eventually got her to the point where she was at 20% plasma cells. And in discussion with the transplant team, we thought perhaps we should just call this good and try to move ahead. But while she was off therapy, she developed back pain, and she was found to have new extramedullary disease, which was causing spinal cord compromise. She was having increasing problems with the pleural effusion. She required radiation and just ended up having a very complicated course along the way as well. She presented with a stroke, and we still don't really understand what led to that. She ended up getting some bendamustine with initial response, and then again, progression, and her progressions are very aggressive. So she has extramedullary disease, medullary disease. Again, on her marrow, you keep finding new clones, and her performance status is unfortunately significantly worsened throughout all of this, including with the stroke. So at this time, I have her on pomalidomide, exazimib, dexamethasone with the thought that we're getting a proteasome inhibitor and an IMID in. I was really not willing to offer carfilzomib because of her amyloidosis and all of her pulmonary issues. And at this point, we're really just trying to control the disease, but we unfortunately don't have a long-term plan. She's clearly not an allogeneic stem cell transplant patient, and she's not even an autologous stem cell transplant patient. So I thought this was just a good example of how you can have a young patient in today's era of having all these therapies available, and you can still have very bad outcomes.
What's your family situation? Does she have children?
She does not. She's single, and her mother always comes with her for all of her appointments. Until recently, though, she has been still working.
So, I mean, myeloma is not an easy disease to treat in general, though, as you say, it's certainly gotten a lot better, but this really sounds like a very, very challenging situation. What's it been like for you to take care of her at a personal level?
It's been difficult. You know, she's somebody who remains very positive throughout this, and I don't want to be all doom and gloom every time I see her, but I really feel that, especially early on when I was just seeing her periodically and the local oncologist was kind of doing the day-to-day things, I always felt like my job was just to deliver bad news over and over again, and that's really difficult. She's very young, and I don't have any long-term options for her.
Maybe we can move on and talk about your 72-year-old man.
Sure. So this is a gentleman that I met within the last year as well, but his story starts back about 5 years ago when he presented with some back pain and was found to have an L1 fracture. He received therapy initially with some Cyborg-D, and then they had to interrupt that to deal with more spinal disease. And after that, his treating oncologist ended up just giving him bortezomib dexamethasone, and he underwent a transplant then in 2012. He only achieved a partial response post-transplant. He still had 25% plasma cells remaining. They did try to kind of clean him up with some consolidation of lenalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone, which at least worked based on the marrow showing post-consolidation less than 5% plasma cells. And then they started len maintenance. I will just note a little detail that in his post-consolidation marrow, there was nothing new on the myeloma FISH panel, but he was noted to have a new deletion 20Q. He stayed on len for a little over a year. It wasn't quite clear to me what the decision was behind stopping the len, but I think it had something to do with concerns about cytopenias. Because of that, he had some additional marrows, which ultimately showed MDS. So then he was just watched from myeloma perspective until the time when he clearly needed treatment for the myeloma. So at that time, they first started trying to give him just a little bit of steroid. That did not control his disease. Bortezomib was added in. That really didn't control his disease. And then he was offered daratumumab. He had some unusual pulmonary issues with daratumumab that were thought potentially to be due to the study drug at that time. And so the daratumumab was stopped. And he then eventually came to me with evidence of disease progression. You know, so he is a little bit older, but his performance status was still good. He plays golf several times a week. He goes to the gym almost every day to do some sort of physical activity. His MDS has not appeared to progress since time of diagnosis, and he's had minimal cytopenias. He's really not required any treatment for the MDS. So the question was, what could I do from a myeloma perspective that would be effective, hopefully, but also not cause issues with his MDS? So right or wrong, I chose to use just doublet therapy of pomalidomide and dexamethasone. I upfront dose reduced the pomalidomide just because of concerns about his cytopenias. And he's really had a fantastic response. He's had complete normalization of his light chains, and he's been on therapy now since about March or April and has been doing really well.
From your point of view, what are some of the teaching points of this case? I think the MDS thing is really challenging.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, so obviously when we think about len maintenance, we always worry about the development of MDS, but really that MDS was actually diagnosed before the true len maintenance was even started. So clearly this was something brewing. It was actually diagnosable post-transplant, but you always have to remember that just having myeloma predisposes one to myelodysplastic syndromes and leukemias, and of course high-dose melphalan predisposes patients to that as well. I think the point of being able to use doublets in today's era is a good one. Obviously, we know that in general, triplets are better than doublets, but not every patient, I think, truly needs triplet therapy. And sometimes it's just about what you can get into a patient safely and still achieve a good response. And in this particular case, you know, low-dose pomalidomide and dexamethasone has really done what we wanted it to do.
Just as sort of a side teaching point, because I find that not everybody's aware of this, which is the issue of using IMiDs in patients with renal dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what this man's renal function is, but I guess he's healthy, presumably normal. But how do you approach the use of lenalidomide as opposed to pomalidomide in patients with renal dysfunction?
So with lenalidomide, I do dose based on their clearance. With pomalidomide, I really don't worry about the renal function. There's just not sufficient data out there to suggest that we need to be dose reducing based only on renal function.
So let's finish out with your 52-year-old lady. It looks like a really interesting case.
So again, she's somebody that I met when she was progressing fairly quickly after a transplant, but her story dates back to 2009 when just kind of on routine labs, she was noted to have an elevated total protein, which then led to the appropriate workup for a plasma cell dyscrasia. So at the time of diagnosis, she actually had a relatively robust M-spike of 2.5 grams of IgG-kappa paraprotein. The bone marrow down at diagnosis showed 10 to 15% plasma cells, so already she's in the at least smoldering category. She had monosomy 13 and then a few trisomies on FISH, but nothing else bad. And then they did a skeletal survey, which was unremarkable, and then presumably diagnosed with smoldering myeloma. When I met her, she had gone through a couple different oncologists, so I didn't have all the records to kind of see how frequently she'd been followed after she was diagnosed with smoldering myeloma and whether any kind of routine surveillance imaging studies were done. But what I do know is that by March of 2015, so about 6 years later, she developed knee pain, and workup at that time then showed that she had widespread bone disease, unfortunately. So clearly in the intervening 6 years, she had progressed to active myeloma. I think one of the points here is that if she had presented in 2017 with an M spike of 2.5 and bone marrow showing 10 to 15% plasma cells, we would not have stopped at the skeletal survey, but instead, based on the newer IMWG criteria, we would have done PET CT or whole body MRI, and in all likelihood would have diagnosed her with active myeloma at that time.
Before you go on, could you review the IMWG criteria and how they've changed?
Sure. You know, so previously it was good enough to say if you had a negative skeletal survey, you didn't need to do anything more, and that was all the proof you needed for not having any bone disease. The IMWG criteria really updated a couple of things. Importantly, with respect to the imaging studies, they have now said that in order to be diagnosed with smoldering, you need to have a negative whole body imaging. That could either be PET CT or whole body MRI. But the important thing here is that we're using much more sensitive techniques to assess for very subtle lytic disease. Of course, the problem with skeletal surveys is the lack of sensitivity. The other couple of things that have changed how we think about smoldering and how we classify it as smoldering versus active myeloma include the bone marrow percentage of plasma cells. So now if the bone marrow plasma cell percentage is above 60% at time of diagnosis, that automatically qualifies the patient as having active myeloma based on a lot of data showing that those patients are at very high risk for quickly progressing to active myeloma. And then the third thing really has been the inclusion of the free light chain ratio greater than 100. And so now if there's a free light chain ratio greater than 100 at time of diagnosis, the patient now qualifies as having active myeloma and should be considered for upfront therapy.
So what happened then with this patient?
So once she was diagnosed with active disease, she received cyclophosphamide bortezomib dexamethasone induction therapy. She achieved a VGPR after 5 cycles. And then she had a standard Melphalan 200 transplant in October 2015. Really appeared to be in a CR post-transplant. She was started on lenalidomide maintenance in February of 2016. And really by July of 2016, she had evidence of relapse disease based on disease in her blood with a positive SPEP. So again, a very short duration of disease control post-transplant, even in the presence of len maintenance. That's when I met her. So she had kind of this new M spike in her blood. She had been on relatively low doses of lenalidomide because of some fluctuations in her liver function tests. And so her treating oncologist had been, you know, a little bit nervous about trying to push the dose. So she had been on only 5 milligrams. We did a bone marrow, of course, before making any treatment decisions. And the bone marrow, when she met me, showed about 10 to 20% plasma cells, but importantly, the FISH showed that she had now picked up a deletion 17P in her myeloma cells. So we had the discussion that this now meant that she had high-risk disease. Of course, already her disease behavior was telling us that she had high-risk disease in terms of relapsing so quickly, but we kind of had concrete proof of high-risk disease features with the new deletion 17P. Here, again, the decision for me was whether or not I tried to kind of maximize lenalidomide before moving on to something else. Since she had been on low-dose lenalidomide, I kind of took the risk and put her on treatment dose of lenalidomide, but in combination with carfilzomib and dexamethasone, which we know from phase 3 data is a very potent triplet therapy. And she initially responded, but then very quickly lost that response. So after 2 cycles, she'd had a partial response, I think. And then after the 3rd cycle, really had stable disease. And after the 4th cycle, had clearly started progressing again. So, you know, I had to have the unfortunate discussion about the fact that she had just been on a very active triplet regimen and relapsed, progressed very quickly on it. The next therapy that I chose was pomalidomide daratumumab dexamethasone. Again, we have excellent phase 2 data in this case, suggesting that this is a very active regimen. We know from some of the daratumumab studies that daratumumab appears to be somewhat agnostic with respect to high-risk cytogenetics. So I had hoped that this would be a beneficial triplet for her. But again, a very similar story. She achieved a partial response after 2 cycles and then started having, you know, just a little hint of progressive disease, not meeting criteria for progressive disease, but kind of numbers going in the wrong direction after cycle 3. I went with cycle 4, went back to weekly daratumumab, just hoping perhaps I could achieve disease control again with that approach, but it did not work. And she actually, on PET CT, had new extramedullary disease. And also just in talking with her, she was like, oh, by the way, I have these new bumps on my head that were clearly plasmacytomas. So again, unfortunately, very aggressive disease that's progressing very quickly through one of the most active triplet regimens we have. At this point, we talked about clinical trials. We talked about likelihood that any additional therapies that are out there are probably not going to be able to control her disease for very long. She really wanted to keep working for as long as possible and didn't want to travel for a clinical trial. And we unfortunately didn't have anything that would be of benefit for her at our institution. So I offered her carfilzomib panobinostat dexamethasone, discussing in great honesty the fact that she had already progressed on a carfilzomib-containing regimen, but discussing the fact that at least with respect to bortezomib, there's data out there suggesting that you can regain sensitivity to your proteasome inhibitor by adding in the HDAC inhibitor. So far, she is responding to therapy. She achieved a PR after cycle 2, but importantly is still continuing to respond. So with her 2 previous triplet regimens, once we got to cycle 3, that's where things went wrong. We just started cycle 4 a couple of weeks ago, and her markers are continuing to respond. She's also had complete resolution of the soft tissue lesions on her skull as well.
That's really interesting. I was curious about why you chose carfilzomib in this situation to pair up with panobinostat as opposed to bortezomib.
Namely because of side effect profile. So although, of course, bortezomib panobinostat dexamethasone is FDA approved and we have a phase 3 study supporting that therapy, that phase 3 study also demonstrated a high number of patients with significant toxicity, particularly GI toxicity. And I've been impressed with the phase 2 study, again, recognizing it's a phase 2 and not phase 3, but with the phase 2 study of carfilzomib panobinostat dexamethasone, where the GI profile is much better. Now, that's probably due in part due to the fact that carfilzomib itself isn't as GI toxic as bortezomib is, but also due to the fact that they switched up the dosing of panobinostat so that it's every other week instead of 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And so, you know, again, I was honest in saying that, look, this really just has phase 2 data behind it. But from a preclinical perspective, I think there's rationale for combining an HDAC inhibitor with a proteasome inhibitor. And again, trying to keep her working for as long as possible meant that I didn't want to give her a therapy where she was running to the bathroom all the time.
And what actually happened? Is she have GI problems?
So it's interesting. She has diarrhea on the weeks that she has panobinostat. She does fine on the weeks that she does not take panobinostat, but it really has been manageable. She manages it with some Imodium, and we have not had to go to extraordinary measures to deal with the diarrhea. We also have not had to dose reduce for any reason. We do see the cyclical thrombocytopenia, but again, at least with each cycle thus far, her platelet count always recovers by the time we're ready to start another cycle.
I think this is really a fascinating case. And when I saw the case, I was thinking to myself, I don't think too many people would have pulled out the panobinostat in this situation, but it obviously worked. And it looks like she clearly was progressing in carfilzomib. So It's almost like a one patient experiment.
Right. You know, the only difference is that the dose of carfilzomib is a little bit higher. But So with this regimen, it's at 45 milligrams per meter squared. I was using it at 36 milligrams per meter squared when partnered with lenalidomide. But I honestly don't think that that is enough to confer the results that we've seen. I really do think that what we've seen in the preclinical setting with combining HDAC inhibitors and proteasome inhibitors suggests that these HDAC inhibitors can overcome proteasome inhibitor resistance. So I think this is really interesting. Obviously, it's an N of one, but I didn't have a whole lot of options because she really wanted to stay close to home. And at the time, we talked about perhaps trying off-label checkpoint inhibitor therapy with an IMID, and we had kind of discuss the pros and cons of that. And then since then, of course, all the data have come out with respect to the pembrolizumab data and the FDA shutting down those studies. So I subsequently have told her that I would not offer her checkpoint inhibitor therapy at this time.
So just getting back to the panobinostat, because it's been kind of hard for me to get a feel. I ask people when they use it or what their experience is. I kind of get the feeling that it's not on everybody's radar that much, particularly in general oncology practice. When you look at both the laboratory data as well as the clinical data, I mean, obviously it was helpful in this patient, but globally, what are kind of some of the situations where you think about this and how helpful do you think it is?
Well, I'll be honest, this is the first time I've ever prescribed the drug. So I always feel kind of bad for the drug when I'm talking about it because I just never have been willing to use it just because I didn't think that the side effect profile was something that was worth the potential minimal efficacy for patients when combined with bortezomib. However, I have paid attention to obviously the carfilzomib data and also the lenalidomide data, and there have been a few occasions when community docs have called me up kind of at a loss for any other regimens, and I've said, well, you could always try the carfilzomib panobinostat dex. You know, I don't know if they in fact ever did. It is a drug, I think, that has been difficult to think about using just because I don't think the bortezomib partnership is the ideal one from a side effect perspective. But I think from laboratory studies and again from resistance mechanisms perspective, we should be thinking about this drug a little bit more. And certainly based on this experience, I'm now going to have it a little bit more at the forefront of my thoughts when I'm looking at patients who are starting to run out of options.
So one final question. You refer to the issue of checkpoint inhibitors, particularly with IMIDs. Do you see that not really heading anywhere at this point?
You know, I'm hopeful that there still is going to be a story there. I don't know whether it's going to be drug specific. Obviously, there are some differences amongst the checkpoint inhibitors that are being tested as opposed to whether they're PD-1 or PD-L1, kind of how modified they are. So I don't know whether this is going to be a global problem. Obviously, the initial phase two data did not show a toxicity profile that was surprising. Certainly, all the autoimmune-based things were expected based on what we've seen with checkpoint inhibitors in other settings.
What was the reason that the trial was set? Was it toxicity or lack of efficacy?
Well, so the FDA first shut down two phase three studies looking at IMID plus pembrolizumab. And they were actually shut down for increased deaths. And so they recently released the Kaplan-Meier curves for two of these keynote studies. And the data are really striking. There is clearly an increased signal for increased death for the patients who are getting pembrolizumab. And this is unexpected. Again, I think everybody expected that we would be dealing with, you know, colitis and thyroid issues and all the typical autoimmune things that we've seen in other disease settings. But to have actually patients die has been very unexpected. And since then, the FDA, I think appropriately, at least until we understand this more, has really started shutting down all other checkpoint inhibitor therapy studies for myeloma right now. But I really do hope that we kind of work our way through this. And I do think that there's potential for the use of checkpoint inhibitor therapy in myeloma. We just clearly don't know yet what that niche is.
But was there any evidence of increased incidence of autoimmune toxicity, or it's not clear at this point?
It's not really clear. They focused more on the deaths. But I think in the initial data that's been released thus far, it also doesn't look like we're seeing, you know, significantly improved response rates or anything like that. But what is clear is an impressive increase in deaths, unfortunately.